Good evening, everyone. I'm your host, Jason Miles, and welcome to another episode of This is Revolution Podcast. If you are a returning listener or subscriber, welcome back. Hella excited to have you guys here. If you're new to the channel, welcome. You enjoy what you are seeing here. If you do like what we do here, please don't forget to leave a like and also subscribe. A lot of you that watch this show aren't subscribing. Is a passive gesture that goes a very long way. If you haven't done it yet, tickets are moving fast and they have added an upgrade for people that have already purchased a ticket for the Washington, D.C. live show June 8th at Bus Boys and Poets. Adolph Reed, Pascal Robert, Daniel Tutt, Derek Varn, and me. Jason Miles, I already got my ticket, so I'm excited and nervous. Please say a prayer for me, people. I do not make a lot of money with this show. This is a labor of love, as you guys know. So buying airfare for someone that doesn't have a credit card, a little difficult. I have to bargain shop. And I did this thing on Priceline where I think they effed me. I'm not very happy about it because I'll be flying back on Spirit Airlines. And I am so not looking forward to it. If there's anything I'm not looking forward to, it is the return flight on Spirit. So if you'd like to, in the comments, leave your favorite Spirit story in the comments. I'm sure you guys have a few that'll get me even more anxious for this very long trip back from DC to San Diego, where I'll get back to Mexico. But the Spirit on the way back is just rough. But today, very excited about the topic. It's something very near and dear to me. It's music, and heavy music at that. Come As You Are. Neoliberalism in the left. Recently, I co-wrote an article with my good friend Alexander Herbert about our appreciation and our time performing heavy music. We also wanted to draw out a comparison between certain tendencies we see in these fringe genres and the contemporary left. If you've read my pamphlet, I Was a Teenage Anarchist, you know that I discuss two contradicting milieus in hardcore that exist in the left, and that's the culture of authenticity and the culture of deconstruction. For me, the culture of authenticity that I've experienced in heavy music is one of forever purity tests to prove one's righteousness. No posers allowed. And everyone is constantly trying to prove they are the genuine article. The culture of deconstruction for me in this situation is the culture of no, against all authority, at all times, against anything, trying to see who is the legitimate. Success is selling out. So what is your end goal? Here's a quote from the article. The cross-pollination of leftist politics with punk has created a situation in which leftism has become as performative as the rock image of the 70s and the cultural protest of the 80s. To be the most authentically punk means to have the most doctrinally informed take and to never be wrong about anything, which necessarily comes at the expense of others. The ego-centered dogmatism blends machismo, often now masked as queer sympathetic, that has always permeated the scene with art-based egos in which personalities can only be validated through intellectual, creative, and sexual dominance within a community that is often imagined to be larger than it actually is. This is why cancel culture is practiced in the hardcore / punk scene more than anywhere else. Why men still frequently cross lines with women. Why people who feel powerless, who lack the intellectual, creative, social, and or sexual capital, often exaggerate accusations, and why bands keep getting called out for bad behavior and treatment of others. Fragile, truly powerless egos have become tied up in a political projection that feeds into the always present search for acceptance and dominance. It is a toxic blend of ego, purity, performance, misdirected masculinity, and false compassion. Again, that is from the article Come As You Are, Neoliberalism and the Left. Please welcome the co-writer, the man that wrote that quote, Alexander Herbert. Hey! Oh, you got a Punks with Lunch shirt. I like those guys. I can't hear you. You're muted.
Where you at? There. There you hey, go. Sorry. There you go. Yep. Shout out to Ale of Punks with Lunch. My homies. Great people. I usually volunteer with them when I visit Oakland, which is once a year at least.
Oh, I didn't know that. How do you they were in West. They used to be the West Oakland. Are they still the West Oakland Punks with Lunch?
Yeah. They are still mostly West Oakland.
Because they were right by where I lived in Soundwave. Mm. And a few of them had bands that would come practice there too. Nice dudes. I really like what they're doing. It's hard to hate on that. Alex, you came to me what about a month ago and said you wanted to write a piece about why you don't go to shows anymore. And then you said, hey, I think we should write it together. I definitely drug my feet because I'm a feet dragger. And you started because you are a doer. And this idea of just an article on your Substack turned into a whole book. So what got you started in the first place? Why did you want to write the piece about why you didn't want to go to shows anymore?
Well, I mean, put it simply, I just don't really want to go to shows anymore.
Like I'm old, it's too loud.
That is part of it. I mean, you know, no, I give a little background. We both give a little background in the article about why and how we're coming at this. And for me, like my experience in punk is like, you know, over 20 years, more than half my life. And it's international. It's still international. I'm still engaging with punks in Europe, and particularly in Russia, where I wrote a book, and I had to interview people and go to their shows and go to festivals outside. And so, you know, as I write in that article, when I was younger in the early 2000s and, you know, until about 2000, I don't know when that was, 2014, maybe, I went to shows all the time. Mostly underground shows in basements and stuff like that. And I loved it. And I really connected with the audience. And then, and I even played in bands. The one I wrote about one in the article, but I've been in other bands too that I wouldn't call punk or anything, but still. And,
you're in your emo phase?
No, actually it was bluegrass. And there was always something about the recognition that I got from playing in shows in bands that I really didn't like. And so I kind of went away from it. I moved away from playing. And also, like, I started graduate school. And so I had to sort of make the calculated choice, which was, am I going to be in a band and try to work towards a successful band, or am I going to focus on graduate school and get a degree and, you know, a career? And so I decided for the career, and most of my friends stayed in music and continued doing it. And to their credit, they've stayed really genuine. All of them have, mostly because they're terrible at promoting themselves, but, but still, and so I, you know, I did graduate school. Then I went to Russia to do graduate school research. But while I was doing that, I researched and interviewed for the Russian punk book. And so I became really, really involved in Russian punk, not just Moscow or St. Petersburg, but sort of everywhere in Western and European Russia. And yeah, that lasted for about 5 years. And in those 5 years, I really lost touch with what was happening in the United States. Who were the new bands and what did people really give a shit about? And so when I was done with the book, I considered it as like, all right, I'm done with punk. I have given back to international punk what it gave to me in my formative years. And I still tried to go to shows here and there. And there was a moment, 2018, 2019, where I was going to basement shows again. And I noticed that the younger people in particular, they seemed more politically aware than my generation had.
Really?
My generation was the late 90s, early 2000s punk. And then for me, it wasn't really that political, mostly because I had grown up around more so hardcore and skinhead subculture. And those guys, they're not really political, right? They say that, you know, skinhead is about working class ethics and working class mentality. But that's as far as it goes. If you push them, well, what is working class? They don't really know. They just know that it means that you work for your money. and so when I saw these newer kids, I was like, damn, they're like passing out copies of the Communist Manifesto. Like, this is dope. Like, some of these kids are really into it. And in my back of my mind, I knew that it had to do something with the emergence of social media. I knew it had to do also with the latent, I would say in my generation, it was latent, the latent anarcho-politics in punk rock, people still doing mutual aid, like Food Not Bombs was still a thing. Mm-hmm. A lot of people that participated in the Occupy movement were of punk from an anarchist perspective. The environmental movement was more anarchist. So I consider those things to be latent, right? Because they're not really organized. There was nobody, at least at the shows I went to, there were people passing out zines, but it was always zines about like their local punk scene or some boring shit like that.
Wow.
And there was nothing like explicitly political. Like, nobody was passing out copies of the Communist Manifesto. And even when you go back and you listen to some of those bands in the late 90s and early 2000s, like Anti-Flag, right? You go back now and you listen to their lyrics, you're kind of like, damn, their politics are really vague. Like, they obviously were anti-capitalists and like anti-establishment, but the politics were still very, very vague, unless the specificity created a punchy chorus line. That was the only time that they were like very, you know, articulate. And so so seeing this new generation for me, I was like, damn. And you know what I came to kind of realize is that all of those elements that added to that latent political element of punk, the carryover from the late 90s and early 2000s, there's an energy there to try to have some kind of political education, but there's no urgency, there's no desire to organize in any way. And so for me, a lot of it became just kind of performative. And there was a video that circulated not too long ago. It was a hardcore singer talking about his job that he had where he had to jerk off a horse. And he was talking about it, how it was labor exploitation. And a video, the video made it like...
Was that the guy from the Red Cord?
Yeah, the video made it, it went viral, right?
Yeah.
And everybody was about it. Everybody was sharing it. And for me, that was like the peak performative position that I could see, because, you know, you have this singer, which, like, good for him on doing that. I'm glad that he talked about it and I'm glad that his point went viral. But at the same time, like, I just started to think, well, what is playing in a band, selling your t-shirts at shows, what does it really do to like further the revolution, I guess, you know, for lack of a better word? How does it actually bring anything forward? And so from that, I just sort of I stopped going to shows because I started to see the inauthenticity of most of these things. And so I would go to shows and, you know, everyone just kind of standing there watching, being really boring, not dancing, not really into it. But they're there because they're expected to be there. Right. Rather than, you know, maybe they like the music or something like that. But there's nothing there that's revolutionary.
Do you think there's an age difference between the people that are a little more active than others? Because there's still, I mean, people moving around. Do they feel like they're a little younger? Or no, is it different where you're from?
I would say, I mean, where I am, I would say a lot of the old heads, if they're not already branded as creepy by the younger ones, then, you know, maybe they help run venues or they're bartenders at certain venues. They don't really do much with the underground scene. They're not really in the basements of you know, basement shows or anything like that. So it could be generational. I think that my generation, definitely, that 90s to early 2000s generation, there's a big political gap. And like I said,
do you think that is, though? Do you think that has something to do with the fact that in the 80s and the 90s, right, there we are two different generations, right, technically? Being what we would now call left, and I still see this today. I think now there's just different branding tools people have, but the mindset's the same. A lot of it is anti-mass consumption. I don't mind my stuff because my stuff's okay. My skateboard is okay, but all your fancy cars are not okay. Your television's not okay. But all the things that I do are totally fine in this capitalist system. But you, other person that isn't part of my scene, is the enemy because you overconsume. All you want to do is consume.
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely a lot of, like, I guess I would call it victim blaming or whatever. or, you know, just kind of finger pointing, I guess, is the actual term for it. There's a lot of finger pointing that happens. And that's a part of the performative aspect, because if you can, it's a lot easier to punch down on people as performance than it is to actually punch up. You see a lot less people punching up, and it happens on the sort of micro scale of just, like, you know, I don't know, boosting people that are doing things that are cool, that actually contribute to community building, and not boosting those people, versus, you know, on the macro scale, which is, I don't know, bands that go on these tours together that play, you know, sold out stadiums, not including younger and maybe more amateurish bands or something, or even just advocating, you know, how many songs about, like, punk unity and community do we have to listen to before we stop believing that the people singing those songs actually mean it genuinely?
What is the purpose of those songs? I guess I would raise that question.
Well, I mean, a lot of that goes back to the history of this stuff. We had to sort of go back to the genesis of punk and hardcore to think about, well, what is the root of this community idea? Where does it come from? And in my mind, punk started in the UK. I know that you could talk about the New York, the US corollary to it, especially at places like CBGB, right, where that is a community in and of itself. All those bands and the people that went to those shows, they knew each other.
I know where you're going with this, and I see what you say. And for me, I would say this. I'm not disagreeing with you 100%. I would just add this. I would say the way we conceive and conceptualize hardcore starts in the UK in the late 70s with the Sex Pistols, because they give you the attitude, they give you the look. New York is all over the place. Television doesn't sound like the Ramones, who don't sound like the Talking Heads, who don't sound like Sonic Youth. A lot of bands come out of that CBGB's no wave slash punk scene that they're it's all mushed together. And they don't really sound similar. By the time it gets to the UK, there is a sound. And when it comes back to America, it's the American take on that sound. And look. and look.
No, no, we're not disagreeing. I agree. I mean, for me, it starts in the UK, as I said, and there is the American corollary to it. But what we're looking at is the creation of this so-called this idea of community, I think, or how community is sort of related to both punk and then the sort of leftism that grows out of it. And, you know, you can see the importance that punk latches onto community very early with the Sex Pistols, with like that whole, what is it? The Bromley contingent, right? That group of kids that included Susie Sue, right?
Oh yeah.
Susie Sue fan. That kind of like coalesced around the Sex Pistols guys.
Mm-hmm. She's on that show where they're die fucker.
Yeah, yeah.
That's how it starts. The dude makes a pass at Susie.
There was one thing that FX special got right, which is that, you know, it is a community. All these people know each other, right? Mm-hmm. And they're kind of in it together. Yes, Malcolm McLaurin is sort of the mastermind in some sense, but people are independent and they all do have agency to some extent, right? And so we start there with the communal aspect. And we can look at the reason why McLaurin or John Lydon or any of them thought that, or the politics that they were informed by, the politics that they were coming out of.
Mm-hmm.
But that sense of community, that sense of coming together to try to create something artistic, to kind of send a middle finger to the establishment, begins there, right? It becomes embedded in what punk rock is. And then it just kind of explodes into these other micro communities, hardcore, 80s hardcore being one of them. 80s hardcore took it to another level, a level where you could go on tours around mm-hmm. the United States and even to the UK, and you could have places to stay. You could, mm-hmm. you know, you could play with bands that sounded similar to yours.
Mm-hmm.
You got to, like, somebody in Boston could be homies with somebody in San Diego just by way of playing the same music. And so you did have this transnational community that started the sense of punkhood. And that sense of punkhood, as you said, a lot of it is based on this idea that you put out there of deconstruction, right, against authority.
Mm-hmm.
And so by nature, it is somewhat political, and it's supposed to be, this is our community against the world.
It's a great feeling, though, when you're young, right?
Yeah.
Like, honestly, when you're a young person and that no future is kind of the motto, I think, to your point about it starting in the UK. The UK gives us all the iconography and the slogans as well. There's really no slogans coming out of New York in the late to mid 70s. But hey, oh, let's go. No, it's no future. That's what it is, especially for Generation X. We can't even name the generation. It's so futureless. It's so hopeless. We just call it X. And the Sex Pistols, for better or for worse, and the music that comes out of that, for better or for worse, gives you the playbook, the script, so to speak. And I think people can project onto that whatever they want. It's a great script.
Mm-hmm.
Because you have bands like the Dead Kennedys, for example. They can't be the Dead Kennedys if all they're listening to is the Misfits. It's not going to happen. Art school students aren't going to connect with that the same way they're going to connect with what Malcolm McLaren's able to do with the Sex Pistols. Right. That's my opinion.
Well, I mean, you have to sort of put them on the timeline, because somebody like Jello Biafra couldn't exist without the Sex Pistols. Sort of the logical connecting thread of politics, and the Clash fit in there as well, right? The Clash mm-hmm. are the band that actually put a solid geopolitical reading to a lot of their, like the song Washington Bullets, for example. That was more specific than any song that the Sex Pistols ever put forward, because it was addressing something.
Well, they were more serious. Can we admit the Clash are more serious than what we get from the Sex Pistols?
No.
You don't think so?
No.
I think
I think the Sex Pistols, the arguments that they were putting forward were broader. They were more general. But you got to understand, they're also starting from ground one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're also starting from nothing. And then it kind of becomes, and we see this today too, the sort of pushing of the line. Well, how specific can we get? How much can we talk about actual politics? I think the Sex Pistols, what they were going for was mostly a cultural critique, right? They're criticizing the rock industry as it was. They're criticizing this glorification or this, I don't know, British obsession with the monarchy and the kind of commodification of beauty.
Mm-hmm.
And they're also doing a whole bunch of wordplay as they're doing it. Like that song Pretty Vacant, right? It's genius because it's saying cunt in it the whole time. And so that's an offense at the time. I mean, that's why Al Grundy?
Mm-hmm.
That's why that Al Grundy show was so important, because that was the pushing of the line. That set the ground for what was to come. And then after that, it was, okay, well, how do we push it even more? Well, let's write an entire song about Spanish bombs, for example. Like, let's keep going with this deeper critique, and let's turn it not just cultural, but let's make it explicitly political as well. Mm-hmm. So there's I wouldn't say that they are like musically a more talented band. So I do take them more serious in that sense, but I take them equally in terms of their specific time and their emergence and their place within this history. I take them equally, I guess.
But let's be honest. I think you have for someone so young, I think you have a very mature, sober critique of Johnny Rotten that I have the utmost respect for. And your critique of Johnny Rotten made me rethink my maybe reactionary opinion of Elder Rotten. And in doing these playlists for these music shows that we do for the Pop Life episodes, I went back and had to listen to some Pill. I think their first record was like 79 or 84, one of those shows. And it's hard to swallow in a very interestingly artistic way, mm-hmm. that I kind of appreciate what he did with a certain level of notoriety and fame for a minute. So you want to talk a little bit about Johnny Rotten real quick?
Yeah, I'd love to. I mean, cause he is sort of a critical component of this history and the genesis. Johnny Rotten, as much as anyone else in that period, comes from the disillusionment that happened at the end of the 60s. You got to think, with the student protests going on in 68, and then the kind of precipitous drop in the in British GDP, in employment rates, that generation was coming up at a time where, like, not too dissimilar to ours, that like things seemed pretty dire. And they seemed helpless, because if the student revolutions of 68 couldn't succeed, then what makes you think that you're going to succeed, right? It seemed like culturally the box was closed. There's no more gaps. There's no more way to get out. And so Johnny Rotten, kind of for me, and Malcolm McLaurin, you can't kind of decouple them at this point yet.
Mm-hmm.
They articulate that, okay, well, if the box is closed, we got to work within the box. But what we can do is we could try to fuck up the box as much as we can from the inside.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of the idea. And Johnny Rotten is kind of at that young age, he's the perfect agent to do that. He's witty. He's quirky. He's, for his own time, he's attractive. He's a snob. He's an asshole. He's all those things like wrapped into one character that can perfectly epitomize the disillusionment of that generation, the utter helplessness that they all felt, to the point where instead of feeling helpless himself, you watch any of the interviews of him at that period, he makes the interviewer feel helpless. I can't mm-hmm. do anything with this kid because he's swearing, or he's not answering the questions, or he's just saying whatever he wants. Like, I can't get anything out of him. So he's flipping the script there. And for me, at that period, that is the best Johnny Rotten. The thing with Pill is that, you know, after the Sex Pistols break up, of course, again, authenticity gets into the mix, especially now towards the end of the Sex Pistols, towards that last show. By that time, there's already other punk bands that are coming up. The Clash is sort of just making its splash on the charts. Or in the sort of punk community that they're coming up with. New York scene is sort of already kind of generating. So you got to push the line a little bit. But the Sex Pistols project implodes, as it has to. It had no future, really. It couldn't do anything else. It couldn't continue. It was a criticism of the rock industry within the rock industry, which meant that it could not exist anymore. It had to blow up on itself. They couldn't peter out, right? They couldn't make their second shitty album. They had to make one, they had to explode, and that had to be it. So Pill was sort of Johnny Rotten's unwillingness to let it go, really. And I don't blame him, because he realized that there's not only can we criticize this music industry, we could make a lot of money doing it. And now that I know the ins and out of it, and I know how artificial it is, I know how arbitrary it is, I know how it operates. Now I can, you know, label this band as not a rock band, but as a limited liability company, that we are in the business of marketing, right? We're not a band. We are a corporation. We're here to sell you something. And that, to me, is kind of like the most authentic thing that I could think of.
That's kind of bad. That's why I did. When you brought that to my attention, I was like, this is why I'm friends with Alex.
He brought it to the next level. He brought that Sex Pistols thing to the next. I mean, look, the Sex Pistols figured out that marketing makes a lot of money. I mean, you could sell patches with safety pins and shit like that. People will buy it. And it wasn't about the music. And Johnny Rotten realized that. Where was it? When they had Sid sing after he quit, that must have been like the sort of icing on the cake for him. It would have been like, it's not about the music. It has nothing to do with the music. It has everything to do with the image. What image can we put forward that people are going to buy? And Pill was not an image, but it was the effort to sell the image more than anything else. The music, say what you will about it. The point is that the music doesn't have to be good. Some of the songs are fine. The music doesn't have to be good. It's about what image can we sell. And there's an interview at the end of, I think, their first full length. It might be called Religion, or it's the self-titled one. There's an interview from the BBC where John Lydon is on it. And it's one of my favorite like B-side things ever. It's just an interview. And they, right at that moment, they're doing the Rock Against Racism in the UK. And the interviewer asks him, well, don't you feel a little bad that you're not participating in Rock Against Racism? Don't you want to see, you know, don't you want to contribute to this cause? And in the most honest, sincere, and like badass way, John Lydon is like, how do you rock against racism? he's like, as far as I could tell, all these bands are, you know, playing sold out stadiums, and the money that they're making is being pooled and being dished out to these, like, you know, record labels and other corporate entities. And he's like, that's my money. I want that money. I'm not going to play for. And he says, he's like, I'm not going to play for some abstract idea, right? This isn't about idealism. You can't rock against racism. Playing at a sold out concert is not going to end racism. But, you know, and he just says, I want that money. It's my music. I want the money. And it was the most sincere thing, I think. And in some way, the most punk thing that you could possibly say at the time.
And I want to get into that. There's a character that I think a lot of people might say there's a direct line you can draw from him to Johnny Rotten. And when it comes to punk authenticity, he probably embodies that, and that would be Fat Mike from NoFX. Is Fat Mike the failure of Gen X Johnny Rotten? He's trying to be Johnny Rotten. He's got the rudeness down. He's got the uncouth nature down. He's got the rude in an interview down. But other than that, what do they really bring to the table?
I was never into NoFX. I just didn't like their music. You know, I think Johnny Rotten sets a precedent for like front men in punk that people like Lou Reed and Iggy Pop are going to pick up on that vibe. Yes, they existed before Johnny Rotten made it big, but they didn't have the personality that we have come to know them until Johnny Rotten had made it big. You go back and listen to Lou Reed interviews from the late 70s and early 80s, and he's just as flippant and like all over the place in those interviews as Johnny Rotten was. And I think, you know, because 80s hardcore never 80s hardcore never really put forward that systemic rock institution criticism. It was sort of implied, right? It's like, because we're doing these things underground, it's a criticism of the institution, but it's not explicit because they can't. Because at that point, the record labels had realized we can't sign these people. They're unpredictable. They're going to do something that's going to cost us money, so we're not going to sign them. Whereas metal, we could talk about that. Metal, you could do that, right? You could actually sign some of these guys, and because metalheads were not afraid.
Here's where the class difference is in these genres of music that no one likes to talk about.
Oh yeah.
Metal, I've only, from my view, has always been more working class than punk. Most people I know are art school people.
Right.
There's a lot of bougie shit going on in punk. Not to say everybody, and just like not everybody in metal is hardcore, but the music, if you think about it, Toure Reid had a good point one day. He was like, I never got into punk because a lot of the people that were into metal when I was in school were the kids that were like good in woodshop.
Yeah.
They took the craft seriously.
Yeah. I mean, I would agree with that. To some extent, because punk, you got to understand, after 77, punk branches off into
a gajillion different things. Yes.
In the skinhead subculture, for example, Genesis in Britain, the trad skin thing, that was, and forever will be a working class thing. Yes. Even though, actually, maybe now, I think, because the uniform is so expensive.
You got Doc Martens and those expensive Fred Perry shirts.
Yeah, now we should say... Now we can say that they're probably more middle class than they were. But at least in the 70s and 80s, that was a thoroughly working class branch, offshoot of punk. And I would say that 80s hardcore, yes, they are probably more of the middle class, but it's kind of the lower middle class. Mm-hmm. It's not the dregs that, you know, we like to think John Lydon was from, even though Johnny Rotten was also probably lower middle class than anything else. Joe Strummer is another one who's thoroughly middle class person. So I guess I would agree with that, the sort of
class. So there's a difference. I can understand to a certain degree this difference in the original metal. Let's go back to Britain again. Let's go back to the UK. Mm-hmm. Metal and punk are really hitting around the same time. If we're looking at 1979, it's around the time like Iron Maiden. Yeah. They don't have their big record, which is Killers, but Motorhead, who's kind of this cross-pollinating group where they have a whole lot of punk speed and attitude, but there's just something a little heavy metal about them. Mm-hmm. Of course, by 1980, a lot of the new wave of British heavy metal bands come out that really give a definitive sound to what we're going to call contemporary metal. And they do not get along with the punk people who are more popular. They're getting all the press write-ups. It's what everybody's talking about. But they're like, well, why do I want to get spit on in a show? That doesn't seem cool. Who wants that? Why do I want to rip up all these clothes? Why would I want to do that?
I think that what happened that turn of the 70s, because you know metal has a more a deeper kind of root in like 70s rock music, Led Zeppelin and all those things. But I also think that what happened is record labels recognize that these metalheads, if we sign them, they're going to be good boys. They're going to make money because that's what they want. And we're going to make money too. Their fans, that's another question. But the band players themselves, they're going to be good boys. The 80s hardcore dudes were unpredictable. You couldn't hire HR from Bad Brains and expect him to do your bidding, you know, and be a good boy for every interview that
Well,
he did.
you couldn't put them in a. Here's another thing. You couldn't put these people in a studio,
Yeah.
a proper studio.
They couldn't play.
You couldn't play, and that was a big factor. We're still in the days of like let's rewind a little bit and let's open up everybody's mind for 5 seconds. I am not a very good player. You can cover up a lot of your inefficiencies with editing. And punk music let you know off bat, we are not good players. We can't keep time. No one's singing. They're not even screaming in key. It is noise for a lot of people. And to give you an idea, there's rock bands. We had the guy that found Kiss on this show. And what did he say when he brought Kiss to the label? When he was an A&R, they were like, this is the dumbest shit I've ever seen in my life. Kiss are very competent players. The original guys are very competent players. But even at that, they're like, no, nah, dude, you're dealing with another level. So you're automatically saying, this is a project where we're going to have to get studio guys in here. Are they going to deal with it? Blah, blah, blah. Yes, they are unpredictable. But I don't think they wanted it because they didn't need it. It wasn't their way out.
Well, think about like Van Halen, for example.
Oh, okay.
Born, raised, trained with the best by the best music teachers that they could that their father could possibly afford, and then straight to stardom. The record labels knew that these people were going to be, like I said, good boys. They were going to behave. They were going to make money for themselves, for the label,
And
for
who
the
discovered
support.
him, right? Gene Simmons. Kind of to this point, like, hey, I know talent when I see it, and these guys got it. Whereas these punk dudes are so against the grain because that's the thing. We don't want to dress like stars. We don't want to act like stars. Whatever
Well,
stars do, we don't want to do.
you got to ask yourself, is it a chicken or the egg? Did that anti-establishment in punk after the Sex Pistols, did that continue because those 80s kids were excluded from the establishment, or were they excluded from the establishment because they were against the system? So I think that like it was clear with the Sex Pistols, the Clash even like pushed their record label to do some pretty uncomfortable things. Sandinista was not supposed to be a triple album, for example. That really pissed the label off. And I think the record labels had lost so much money on punk in that cross to this from the 70s to the 80s that they were like, we need something else. We need some people that are going to be like that are going to behave, that are going to do what we need them to do and not push us more. And so I think that because of that, 80s hardcore adopted that anti-establishment, and then it kind of just became a part of the image as well.
It definitely becomes part of the image. I think the image is just, you know, the middle finger. It's no. The image is no. And with heavy metal and hard rock, because a lot of these guys are pulling from the same sources. It's another thing. A lot of the, regardless if Jello Biafra knows the Sex Pistols, you know who else he knows? David Bowie. He does know who Kiss is. He does know Yes. He does know Led Zeppelin. That stuff was just too big, right? He may not like it. I've talked to him one time in my life. We talked about the Broncos and John Elway. But it is interesting to think that these guys are pulling from the same places, but they're going very different directions with it.
Yeah.
I do dig that to a certain degree.
I think so. Yeah. I mean, 80s hardcore is unable to replicate any kind of deep systemic criticism of the industry because it doesn't have access to the industry. So what it does by default is form its own community outside of the community, right? In relation to metal that is entering the mainstream, in relation to now new wave has entered the mainstream, right? New wave bands is blow up in the 80s, but these hardcore kids, they remain in the middle and they're excluded from it. The music is too abrasive. They're all unprofessional. They're all unpredictable. And now that they've been excluded, now they're going to take the position that, well, we don't want it anyway, right? Because we have our own thing.
But to your point about new wave, I'll pull you back even further. It's 79. The Knack and My Sharona, that's 79. That's when everybody's got a skinny tie. Mm-hmm. Synthesizers are huge. The industry does like new wave. It's cheaper to produce. I believe Depeche Mode's first record is 79. If it's not their first, it's one of the early ones. The Cure drops in 79. I can't remember the name of the album. A lot comes out in 79. The Germs also come out in 79, I believe.
That's why we call it post-punk.
But it's you know, it's 79, right? There's punk that were new at records. And then it's all of a sudden post in 79 as well, which I find find fascinating. But another pushback to new wave is glam.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Motley Crue, to some extent, was like, we don't want to wear skinny ties like the Knack.
Yeah.
We want to rock.
I think, yeah, I mean, I think a lot of that had to do with what to go back to the Sex Pistols, it had to do with what the implosion of the Sex Pistols implied for the project that was the Sex Pistols, not even their sound, not even like punk, but what the Sex Pistols intended to do when it imploded in 1978, the people, I mean, because you look at a band, a lot of these like new wave bands that will come out of Britain after 78, all of them are directly influenced by the Sex Pistols. They grew up worshiping the Sex Pistols for the brief 2 years that they were really around. And so I think that implosion signaled briefly, punk is dead. It died with the Sex Pistols at, what is it, Winter Wonderland or whatever in San Francisco. Winterland, that's the name of it. It died there. And even the Clash, you know, they have their first album, the self-titled. They don't play punk after that.
Mm-mm.
You tell me other than that one, maybe brief one that was really shitty when most of the band quit, except for Joe Strummer. I forget what the name of that album is, but they didn't play punk anymore. They switched genres, which is what makes them, I think, more versatile and stuff like that. But everybody gave up punk briefly after 1978.
Again, it
was unpredictable. The record labels weren't having it because of what happened in Winterland.
It wasn't viable music. It just wasn't viable because you weren't going to fix it in the studio. You got to remember this. Take a record like The Germs' first record. I'm so mad that, you know, people are so mad about intellectual property that if we played 5 seconds of that record, the show would probably come down. But that record, if you shine it up, still sounds like a turd. I know there are people that love it. They cry when they hear it. I get that. But you can't take those guys to a big studio and get a cleaner version of that.
Yeah.
I think they actually recorded it in a decent sized studio. But it is what it is. Punk doesn't become a viable genre until you change the name and everyone's okay with recording cleanly. You call it grunge.
Mm-hmm.
You put Nirvana in a big ass studio and they sound phenomenal and sell 11 million records. We'd stop calling it punk after that. If you
the whole Nirvana thing was punk is dead. We are the harbingers of punk's death. You know, and Toussaint in the chat brought up Joy Division. Joy Division's one of those bands that I was just talking about of from Britain that admired the Sex Pistols, but because they didn't really kick off until the Sex Pistols were done, mm-hmm. they didn't play punk music. They played post-punk, you know, because punk was over. So there was this brief period where that brand of punk was done. The 80s kids tried to bring it back, but they couldn't.
James Phipps says, the crash erasure here is happening. It's disturbing.
Crash, yeah.
I'm sorry we're not bringing up crash, because they exist in the same timeline as well.
Yeah, but they suck.
Wow, I'm not going to go that far.
Yeah, I never liked Crass. Okay. Their music is really boring to me. Lyrically, like, they have points. They're, like, political. I get that. They're all about that. But musically, it's sort of like The Exploited. Another one of those punk bands that, like, the songs suck.
Oof.
Like, I get that you have the image, but, like, I don't know. Tell me a good catchy.
I want to get close to the camera. The views expressed by Alexander Herbert do not reflect the views of Revolution.
Stop pretending that the Exploited is a good band, please.
I never got. You know who I got into out of all those British bands? I got into Discharge. Discharge is dope.
Discharge has some bangers, some real great.
They have some real bangers.
Yeah.
But I want to come back to the idea of changing the name. If you think about this moment in the 80s, there's a fear in the kids that make the music. No Future has become, again, it's the moniker of an entire generation, is Generation X, the blank generation. And in the 80s, when we're talking about all these hardcore bands, whether they're in the UK or in the States, whether they're just saying politically conscious stuff or they're not, they frighten conservative America, and they definitely frighten conservative UK. And the reason why I'm so fascinated by a movie like Repo Man, which is filmed in about 83 and it's made in 84, it comes out in 84.
Mm-hmm.
The scene, I wouldn't say is dead, but I think for my own intents and purposes, I think the re-election of Ronald Reagan is a death nail to some of the people that are more serious about it being true counterculture. And again, these bands were never playing stadiums. They were always pretty small, and the scenes were always really small. But their imagery was frightening enough, right? And it's like they bought into the idea that they really were some sort of vanguard. But of what? If you were to ask them, of what? They probably couldn't answer that. And there's a great scene in Repo Man. Or I wouldn't say scene. There's scenes with these kind of robbing thieves of punks that are kind of supposed to embody this culture. And they're suburban kids that just do crimes. They're like, come on, let's go do crimes. And they kill and they kind of pillage. And when one of their friends, I'm sure you've seen the movie Repo Man, and I'm not spoiling anything. The movie's older than Alex. If you haven't seen it, and this is a spoiler for you, stop being so sensitive. One of the punks opens the trunk. He disintegrates. The other punks look at him and they go, let's go get sushi. And the other one says, and steal it.
Mm-hmm.
And that to me is the 80s in a nutshell. The way we really, that's to me the accurate view of these people. They're not as threatening as you want them to be because they're not as serious as you want them to be. Right. These aren't activists, students of 1968, the way we want to make everything 1968. Right? And by the time you get to 1991, Because Nirvana's first album, I forget if it was 90 or 89, it comes out. But a lot of these bands are doing stuff in the late 80s. But by the time you get to what we call grunge, that's just hard rock and punk. But those words aren't commodifiable anymore. Because that means shitty musicianship, screaming into a microphone about bullshit nobody cares about. Mm-hmm. And in Penelope Spears, and I'll jump ahead to this, Penelope Spears makes a third Decline of a Western Civilization. The first one is a very serious movie about what she was seeing in the hardcore scene in the early 80s, how it was so antithetical to all the rock and upcoming metal stuff. You know, Lemmy's in the first Decline of a Western Civilization. She comes back a few years later and says the LA Strip is filled with these dudes with big hair putting flyers everywhere. And she wanted to know what was up with that scene. And she does one on the glam scene, which is almost comical. Then she comes back in like 93 and wants to see what's up. A lot of venues closed. Music is in this weird way, especially in LA, because everything is in Seattle now. And she goes and talks to some punks, because again, the story is supposed to always be about the fringe people, the punks. That's why she ends the second one with Megadeth. And she's bored. They're just preaching to a choir. Mm-hmm. What are you guys going to do? Oh, I think we're going to play this abortion rally. And then we're going to do... It's just like, okay.
I think it's the first one where... Darby Crash is in it, right?
And yes.
There's that scene where they're in his kitchen.
Oh,
yeah. I'm remembering this right. And she's asking him, like, you know, why do you do these things to yourself? And his best answer is, like, because it's cool. Like, that's all he can really say. I mean, he hates his life. He claims that he hates his life, and he probably did. And he's just like, this is the best thing I could think of doing, and it's cool. So they're like, that the scene that you described in Repo Man reminds me, there's that movie Suburbia with Flea in it.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that's the one with the scene where they go into a convenience store and they put dye in the deviled eggs. Uh-huh. And there's no reason for it. It's mm-hmm. just, that's what you do. That's the image of being punk, right? It's a fucking like asshole. So the image of punk is kind of like, if you could imagine, it already is a certain image in 77, 78. It's degraded even more in the 80s. The mainstream hates it so much that even in the movies that it appears in, it's a joke. These hardcore kids, you know, these the Germs and Circle Jerks and all those kids, like, first of all, they're kids. Second of all, they're just troublemakers. They don't actually have any, like, coordinated political ideology organization. They're just against the world that their parents raised them in, right? And that's an important part, because it's suburban. That's why the movie's called Suburbia, right? The kids are rebelling against what their parents are about, and they're kind of masking it as, this is my political protest, and I have. But then again, go back to the beginning of the conversation, the important part is, this is a community. This is a community, and as such, over time, the limits of entering that community are more and more defined. Political litmus tests, fashion, the people you know, the bands that you know, all these things become barriers to entry, right? You got to know the right stuff. You got to wear the right stuff. You got to listen to the right stuff. And that's a process that happens over time. And you see some people in the 80s that are resisting that. Someone like, you know, Henry Rollins, for example, kind of exists in this weird place in between in the 80s, in my opinion, where he is the epitome of hardcore for a lot of people at that time. But he's also in the interviews, some of the interviews that he does, he's like pushing back against these like litmus tests for what it means to be hardcore. Someone like Ian MacKaye is doing the same thing, to the point where Ian is like, fuck it, I don't want it anymore. I don't want to do it. And that's, again, partially why I think, to get back to Nirvana and this whole grunge thing, is why I think, again, it's more financially, socially, culturally appealing for the people that make money, for the people that profit off of this. And that's why it was easy for grunge music, people like Nirvana, for example, to come forward and say, we are the death of punk. The Red Hot Chili Peppers, punk, even Flea is in that band, right? We are the death of punk. We're a new music. You're not really defining what that new music is. It's a little slower paced, maybe, but it's still got the distorted guitar. And, you know, they're wearing plaid shirts instead of band t-shirts. It's like, okay, you're defining a new genre based on a slight change of sound. But what you're actually do is you're challenging the legitimacy of this community, which is only going to force it to close in on itself even more. Right. So by that time, you get like Youth Crew hardcore, super, super closed in. You got to shave your head. You got to wear the Chain of Strength t-shirt and the Youth of Today. Right. You got to be all about those group chants and stuff like that. You got to go to the Slapshot show or whatever the fuck it is, right? It closes ranks even more. One of the effects of grunge, I think, grunge music.
I mean, again, I think you're speaking to what I try to talk about in the pamphlet and what we're probably going to expand on in this book, which is these scenes are so closed off that you really can't build anything. And they're kind of designed not to build anything, other than for the immediate people there. They're very inward looking. The music itself, I think, and a lot of people don't want to agree with this, but it is very kind of self-centered music to a certain extent. And when you talk to a guy like Vincent Bevins, whether you like him or not, a lot of those movements that he discusses in that book start with anarchist punk people. Mm-hmm. Those movements that blow up in their faces and get co-opted. And that I think is maybe these genres at their best.
Yeah, maybe. You have to, so, you know, after you've gotten to the point where you're willing to concede that by the mid to late 80s, punk or hardcore or whatever, it sort of closes, it becomes this kind of closed community, closes ranks, it limits who's allowed in, it becomes exclusionary in a lot of ways, it becomes ego-ridden. You have to take that reality, right? I already mentioned that, in my opinion, in the 90s and early 2000s, there's a sort of drop off. You get weird, you get pop punk, right? The furthest that the establishment will go in punk is Rancid, right? But for the most part, you get pop punk. It's more palatable to people. It's funny. Blink-182, Sum 41, all those bands, they're not singing about politics. They're singing about being goofy white guys. And then, I mean, we could talk more about that, but for me, that's the logical, there's something, there's a jump that happens there where now we live in a time, social media has to do something with a jump. Now we live in a time where the politics has reemerged into this now closed community, right? The community as it is now is a closed entity. It monitors who's in it, but now it's also political. And not only is it political, but it's advocating for a type of political ideology that has the word community in it. Communism is community. So how do you square that when you have something like punk hardcore that is by nature, by evolutionary logistics, exclusionary, has a lot of litmus tests?
Well, can I give you my reasoning on that? This is just my that I'm been working through, and I'll be working through as we write this book or as we finish it up. 84 is an important year because Reagan is reelected in the landslide, and I think a lot of the dreams of this counterculture or this burgeoning counterculture are squashed. Bands break up, people die. It's the scene, of course, still persists, but not like it did before. It becomes parody. This is when the 80. That's another reason why record labels don't want to fuck with these movies. They're just parody at this point. They're a joke on Saturday Night Live. When you look at 1994, it's a very important year because two things happen. Kurt Cobain dies. All of those dudes are megastars now. These guys that were, for the most part, punk bands, right? Soundgarden, Nirvana, Pearl Jam, Alice in Chains. Kurt's the first one, the first big one, because nobody knows who Mother Love Bone is. But Kurt's the first big one to go down. It's going to take a few more years for Layne Staley to go down and a few decades for Cornell to go down. And these bands are now arena rock bands.
Mm-hmm.
When that happens, the derivative of that is, well, now we can sign punk bands.
Mm-hmm.
Sign Green Day. They're perfect.
Yeah, because now the name of punk has also been brought down. It's been nullified.
Right? But
the label.
But let me add this to Green Day. I'm not the biggest fan, but I can't shit on their quote unquote credentials. They did do the independent touring thing. They were on a really small label, the equivalent of an SST at the time. They are the reason why that label had any money, because they let them have that first record for, I forget how many years they let them have it for. And they signed a major label deal. And the music, much like grunge, isn't about anti-war protests and challenging authority as much as it is about introspective looks at your own failures as a human that a lot of teenagers can relate to. Dookie blows up and a million imitators are born at the same time we have a blow up of extreme sports. Right? Soon after, we're going to get stuff like the X Games. So now there's a whole industry built around suburban kids. Also around this time, we're seeing the end of Glass-Steagall. 94 is when it starts. And we're getting a lot of financial deregulation that's allowing all this cheap credit to flow, or easy credit to flow. And the suburbs are being built out. Mall culture is on a whole nother level. So unlike we got in the post-war World War II, where it's the state helping you achieve these capitalist dreams, the market's helping you achieve these capitalist dreams.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very short-lived. And the Blink-182s that are a derivative of Green Day and all the other bands that follow just kind of cater to this new massively large industry. To at the end of the 90s, you get stuff like Avril Lavigne. We never would have thought in 1989 that we see a punk rock princess, if you will, like you see with Avril Lavigne. Well, the first song, right? She kind of abandons that thing a little later. So pop punk, to me, was the perfect marketing that they couldn't do with grunge. Grunge was brooding and important. This music was frivolous and silly. It's perfect to sell shit for. It's perfect to sell shit to kids for. And kids now had buying power. Look at all these music festivals we get in the 90s as well. There is a massive industry around this shit. And it's, to me, a lot of that was forgettable music.
Yeah.
I don't know if it stands the test of time.
No, yeah, I agree. I mean, one thing that we didn't bring up about that also really emerged in the 80s, but it was always present in punk and probably doubly so in the 70s too, but that has never really, existed and is also in contradiction with the communal aspect of punk is the topic of nihilism, right? Something that we didn't talk about because the whole, you know, the Sex Pistols No Future, right? The sense of hopelessness that is both individualistic, I think, nullifies the efforts that are made later. Like, you know, as I mentioned, I think earlier in the episode, like mutual aid is one of those things that stays within punk, especially through the 80s when, you know, it becomes meshed with environmental activism and animal rights in the 90s. And mutual aid is one of those things that also kind of stays with it. But again, like how effective is mutual aid if it's not politically directed towards any cause except for some broad sense that, well, we have to feed the homeless, right? It's not a political project. It could also be a sort of demonstrative thing as well. Because when you couple those things with nihilism, I think they nullify each other. I don't know. So, yeah, by the time you get to the 70s, most of that stuff is, in my opinion, you know, of course there are punk bands in the 90s, both in the mainstream and underground. I'm not saying that punk totally disappeared in the 90s, but I am saying that it lacked the same kind of basis that it had in the 80s or in the 70s. In the 70s, it had an institutional basis. The Clash, the Sex Pistols, these people were signed. In the 80s, it had this underground network that was very real. In the 90s, yes, there are big bands that are signed. Yes, there are underground bands that have the underground network, but it's no longer anything with political potential. It's no longer powerful. And it's contradicted by the underlying nihilism that is also feeding into this individualism that we're talking about. And so all the efforts of mutual aid becomes not a political mutual aid, but mutual aid just for mutual aid's sake, almost, in my opinion.
Give me an example.
Food Not Bombs. Mm. I mean, that's the best example. They're still at it, right? Mm-hmm. They really come about in the 90s. But you know, what is their political program? Feeding the homeless. That's not really a political program. That's a social cause that you're devoted to. That means a lot to you, but it's not a political program. It's not really
organized. Altruism.
Yeah. And a lot of those organizations collapse too, because they're like anarchist, anti-authoritarian, right? And so they don't have any internal, structures of organization. So they just sort of collapse on each other. There's a Food Not Bombs still active in every city, run by three people that don't get along with each other, so they don't do it anymore, right? Mm-hmm. They still exist. They just don't do it anymore. They all hate each other, and nobody knows who's in charge. I'm not going to drop any names, but there's an anarchist collective in my area, my broad area, who they have a brick and mortar building.
Oh, wow.
And we when I used to volunteer at the library, we would reach out to them to do things in collaboration, and they would be like, yeah, we'll get back to you. We have to talk to our board about it. And they never got back to us because nobody knows who's in charge. And most of these people are involved in the punk scene. And so, you know, that like somebody got the text message and was like, OK, I'm gonna bring this up at the next meeting. They either forgot to bring it up at the next meeting, or they brought it up and it led to a debate within the meeting. No, we shouldn't work with these guys, or yeah, we should work with these guys. And that just went nowhere because there's nobody that could just say, yes, we need to do this. This is a good idea. And that's kind of the case with most of these like mutual aid initiatives that exist that continue through the 90s. And it even trickles into the political punk of the 90s too. The whole like in the 80s, the whole like, street punk, British street punk movement, anarcho movement. That's where you get the leather jackets with the studs and the spiky ass hair is where it starts. What is that doing politically?
I want to address this. This person, James Phipps, has been, you know, doing backflips in the chat because you're not talking about his favorite bands. This is the problem that I think people like this don't understand when you talk about the culture of authenticity. First of all, when you're talking about a movement or music on a mass scale, if I start getting into the weeds about people that no one really knows on a big level, people that never really got to the stadium level, that's a conversation you want to have with your friends, right? We're trying to explain broader things, and you want to have the friend conversation, first of all. And to act as if music and small organizations that do fold very quickly, there's proof in the pudding. James, where were you when all these big protest moves were? I didn't see any James Phipps posts when Vincent Bevins was here talking about all of the failures of these anarcho-punks trying to do in Brazil, right? Trying to eliminate the fare of the buses, and the whole movement gets co-opted. All these movements got co-opted.
I think that, like, we can give and take, right? So, I mean, James brought up his queer friends that are alive because of these movements. And I grew up in this stuff. Jason and I both did. I have, you know, been in punk. You know, first show I went to, I think I was 8 years old. It was a Dropkick Murphy show when they were all still skinheads.
You weren't punk enough, you right? Someone's going to say you weren't punk enough.
I was too young.
That's not a punk enough show.
If it was after they had hung up their boots, now how they all are now, then that wouldn't be punk enough. But no, this was way before. And but it did. I mean, it gave me something important. Belonging to punk has made me who I am today. It's made me the critic. It's made me, you know, the polemicist that I am. It's made me kind of the compassionate person that I am. Made me a dope father. I'm trying to publish a book right now about being a punk parent because punk gave me so much. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it politically has amounted to nothing on a mass scale because those initiatives that are adjacent to punk, whether it's that 80s underground movement or it's sort of umbrella movements, Food Not Bombs, or, you know, the few times that it did coalesce into something bigger, a lot of the Occupy Wall Street people were of the punk movement. They all kind of collapse, and they collapse because there's a whole bunch of reasons for it that we're trying to get into right now. They collapse because of individualism. They collapse because of the contradictory nihilism that is underneath them all. They collapse because of the way that these scenes are structured as sort of simultaneously closed to entry, but communal in aspiration, I guess we could say. There's a whole bunch of reasons. And so to answer James, like, we're not saying that punk sucks and didn't help anybody. Of course it did. We're saying that, like, if we look at it now, and we can move on to this point. If we look at it now, there is a blending that's going on between leftism, Marxism, I want to call it Marxism more specifically, or socialism, with punk and hardcore, that there's a whole bunch of contradictions that are exacerbated because of this. And there are historical roots to it. So what Jason and I are trying to do is to talk about these historical roots. Well, what are some of the possible causes, effects? How did we get to this point? And then now, how do we sort of dot the lines here? How do we make sense of the fact that there is a hardcore scene now that where bands like the one I mentioned in the beginning of the show will get up on stage and say something that is explicitly Marxist and say, you know, I'm a communist on stage. But as Jason said, they're not really seen participating in all that much politically.
They'll show up at a rally, maybe after the thing's already started. They're definitely not in the front. I just don't know if I look to music the way I did as a young person as a force for change.
That's the logical, that's the conclusion that we're coming at, because I think that because in social media, and this goes back to the story that I told at the beginning, you know, going to the underground show, seeing somebody handing out copies of the Communist Manifesto that they had printed on their own home printer. For me, that was wholesome. And that was something that, all right, in the Communist Manifesto, they argue explicitly, you need to join an organization. You need to be a member of a party. You need, that's how you fight this system. So for me, seeing that, I was like, oh shit, this is something. We have 100 people in this room right now. If all of them read the manifesto and this fucking rinky dink printing of it, then that's 100 more communists in the city that I live in or wherever you are. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't happen that way. Instead, because it doesn't happen that way repeatedly, the only logical conclusion from there is that a lot of it is performative. Because when it comes down to it, it's, you know, these bands are also trying to sell. They're trying to sell tickets, they're trying to sell merch. And so you even have like people on social media who they have the punk aesthetic and they sell t-shirts with the hammer and sickle and some like quote from Marx on it, right? And for me, it's all related. It's again that kind of culture of inauthenticity, this DIY ethics, which is another thing we didn't talk about, blending into the political theater, Marxism. And we're trying to talk about, well, what are the components of that? What's the root of that? And what are the consequences of that? And how authentic is that? And so when you say neoliberalism, punk and neoliberalism, I think that that's what we're looking at. We're looking at people who have a very vague understanding of what Marxism is. They think that it means, they think that it's synonymous with progressivism. I'm pro-choice. I'm against, you know, the Democrats and Republicans, but that's not what Marxism is.
What is it?
Well, it's a lot of things, right? It's a class analysis. It's a view of history that is dialectically materialist. It looks at the world from the perspective of the economic basis, the economic relations of people in society. And it tries to understand why it is that people act, the culture that they create, the relations that they have as a function of their material condition. Right. And so the Marxist political project is to challenge that material condition.
Bill Cody just jumped in. We've said so much shit about punk and music that Bill Cody just jumped in and said, are you guys talking about Bruce Springsteen's good old pal Tom Morello? Rage Against the Machine is an interesting case in point because I don't think that they're inauthentic to what they care about politically. Do I believe Tom Morello sees himself as a communist, whatever that means? I believe that whole band sees themselves as communists for whatever that means. I do. I really believe that. They still play arenas. They still wanted to get a record deal. They still, you know, made a good amount of money in the 90s and 2000s. And I'm not mad at that. But what does it say? Because I think it's bigger than them. What does it say when your music is so explicitly communist that all people get from fuck you, I won't do what you tell me, is just fuck you, mom. Fuck you, dad. It feels like that's all people got. When Paul Ryan is like, oh yeah, I loved Rage Against the Machine. I didn't know they were political. What do you mean you know they're political? There's hammers and sickles everywhere. There's stars everywhere. There's videos of Shining Path behind them while they play on stage. And people are like, I didn't know they were political. Battle of Los Angeles album cover? You didn't know they were political? Let's shut down the New York Stock Exchange with a camera crew. You didn't know they were political?
I think, you know,
you could commodify radicalism and no one cares. How many, was it you talking about this or was it Bert? I can't remember who was talking to about this morning. But the fact that there's so much talk anti-communist or anti-capitalistic talk. There's so many movies. We have Oscar-winning anti-capitalist movies. Capitalism really is, as Mark Fisher said, like the monster in The Thing. It just keeps changing shape. And the only thing people can see is this kind of neoliberal solution, or neoliberal solutions, if you will. The foundation world, private interests can save us, not politicians.
Yeah, anti-capitalism has become catchy. It's that argument that the capitalist realism argument of Mark Fisher, right? That it's easier to imagine the end of the world than it is to imagine the end of capitalism now. And that is most realized, most vivified, I guess, by the fact that you have bands like Rage Against the Machine that say things that are explicitly anti-capitalist, but it's not internalized as such. As, you know, I watched a video, I shared a video recently of Tom ranting on stage. I forget what he was talking about, but it was like a criticism of the state, it was a criticism of religion, criticism of politicians, but he didn't drop the word capitalism once. And you know, this also happens in academia, because as an environmental historian, I talk a lot about climate change and stuff, and you see a lot of established, really great historians criticize capitalism because of what it has done to the environment, but they'll never criticize capitalism explicitly. They'll say, we need a new way of thinking about nature, we need a new relationship to it, because the one that currently exists is wrong. We need new institutions and new laws and blah, blah, blah. But they'll never say that we need capitalism to go away. It never gets there, right? And the same thing is I think, the case with music. That's what I meant when I was saying earlier, you go back to bands like Anti-Flag, and yeah, they have some things that are anti-capitalist that are catchy, but they're not part of a party. Imagine if a band like Anti-Flag, with their influence and their clout in the late 90s and early 2000s, imagine if they were members of the Communist Party and they were out about it, mm-hmm. and they were public about it. Do you think that they would have gotten as much recognition? And do you think that they would have also netted a whole bunch of people to join the party with them? Probably. But they don't. And why is that? Is it because saying that you're communist is dangerous? Saying it explicitly is dangerous, but performatively suggesting that you are communist, that's okay. Because culturally, people will just accept it. Just go along with it. But to say so explicitly is another story.
I mean, to say it in the 80s and 90s was a little dangerous. You're edgy. I think people still see it as something edgy today. It's not as, but it's still a bit edgy. But, you know, I'll quote something I wrote. How arrogant of me. Either you're raging at the machine, against the machine, or you're raging to be a part of the machine. But the machine always exists.
Yeah.
And that's kind of my point with a lot of the stuff that I do, is that there's this machine that sometimes we don't even want to acknowledge what we're supposed to be raging about. And it's there, it's not going anywhere. So it's like, well, how can I make this rage make sense for me? Right? Mm-hmm. Every aspect of my life is going to be commodified. I'm on Etsy now.
Somebody asked, so what Communist Party were Rage Against the Machine or Anti-Flag supposed to join? It doesn't matter. I don't care. It doesn't matter. I mean, for me, it's more the importance of joining something and being upfront with that. That could have been a mobilizing tool at that moment, but it wasn't, and it still isn't. So you don't get bands that are like, that say that they're part of, I don't know, Communist Party, DSA, PS, whatever the fuck you want. It doesn't matter to me. What matters is, like, there is a difference between being a member and then being performatively anti-capitalist. And insofar as it's performative, nobody takes it for what it is, and nobody knows what to do with it. You kind of threw a ball at them, and then they don't know where to throw it, right? And that's the problem for me. And that has to do with punk's inheritance and anarchism, right? Which is anti-party by nature. It has to do a lot, but you know, it's been 40 years now of anarchism.
Like imagine people that just like hella preppy ass people like going into a punk show.
Yeah.
Yikes.
Yeah, for real.
Taylor Swift shirt, yeah.
But they should be allowed. My dream of a punk scene is one that doesn't care what fucking t-shirt you're wearing. Mm-hmm. Just come in, just join, you know, be a part of what we're doing here. You don't want to dance? Fine, that doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. You never heard of fucking, I don't know, what's the big band now? Knocked Loose? You never heard of Knocked Loose?
Are they the Turnstile? But I don't know.
Turnstile got really big for a bit. Yeah, I was in a fucking Target and I saw a single mom pushing her young, like 3-year-old in the carriage, just blasting Turnstile from the phone. And I was like, what is this world?
Why these times have changed.
Yeah.
Well, look, we've been doing this for the time flew by.
Yeah.
If you guys are enraged or interested in anything we had to say, wherever you're watching or listening to this show, we wrote down a lot of these opinions in our latest article in Sublation. I think I've been calling it the wrong title.
I took notes, and thank you to everybody who's been commenting. I've been taking notes and everything, so thanks.
Come As You Are, Punk and Neoliberal Leftism. That's what I wanted to call it. And I did ask Alex if we could call it that, and he was like, fine. Fine. I have to call it something of a song. I gotta do that. The play on the music.
No, I do that too. I mean, I was just going to call it Why I Don't Go to Shows Anymore.
Yeah.
That's the answer to the question, you know?
I was like, no, let's call it Come As You Are.
But we spelled it C-U-M.
I'm super stoked. Alex is a doer. I am to some degree as well, as doing this goddamn show for so long. But the motivation, I want to say this on air in front of the viewing audience and Jesus, the motivation and courage you have given me to do this book, thank you. I appreciate
it. I couldn't think of anyone else to do it with, to be honest. There's nobody who, I mean, just this episode, bouncing opinions back and forth, the knowledge that you have of the 80s, the knowledge that you have of the bands of the 80s. I am notoriously very, very bad at recalling song and band names and celebrity names. I'm terrible at it. I've heard everything. You send me a song, I'd be like, yeah, I heard that. Mm-hmm. I couldn't tell you who it was. I couldn't tell you the name of the song. I can't even sing songs. I'm terrible at remembering lyrics. I remember these structures, right? I remember history and stuff like that. So I couldn't think of anyone else to do with that could be able to recall these necessary details to make the point stronger. So it's my pleasure.
Jeremy Logan says, do a call-in show about punk. Oof. I almost did tonight. I was real close to doing it tonight. And then I was like, I don't know if I hate myself that much. Just kidding. If you guys are down for a call-in show about punk, that can be arranged. I'm booking out June right now. If you want Alex back on, I can try to arrange that. Maybe I can't, because you're leaving in June. You're doing your promotion for your documentary, right?
Yeah, I'll be in Europe all June. Let's do a call-in show late. Let's let this stew for a month. And then we'll come back to it.
Come back and do a call-in. I would love to hear people tell us to fuck off. Look, I appreciate the Jameses of the world that push back. I appreciate that. If you don't get that pushback, then your arguments aren't sharp.
Well, also, like, I don't know about you, but I've discovered more and more, especially, you know, the whole Israel-Palestine thing that's going on now, the genocide that's going on now, and feminism, questions about feminism that I've brought up on my like personal page, I've found that people get really, really passionate about things that they themselves care about and they identify with. I had criticisms of the sex industry, for example, and I never got so much pushback by people who were tangentially involved in the sex industry before because it mattered to them. And so I expect the same thing here. So people like James, who like me, probably grew up listening to punk and really took a lot from their participation in punk communities. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a extent to which when you're engaging with these things, you have to kind of suspend that personal bias for a second. And you got to be able to step outside of it and be like, huh, I didn't realize that some of that stuff is right, even though I love it, even though I'm about it, even though, you know, I don't know any genre better than punk music, with the exception maybe of classical music. You have to be able to suspend that stuff and be like, all right, let's criticize it from the outside. And it's hard to do, but.
Did you see what Mercutio wrote about you? I won't read it out loud.
Yes. Yeah, for real. That's true.
Well, we're going into the champagne. Are you joining me in the champagne room?
Yeah, I'll be in there for a bit.
Do you want to, you know, can we have that conversation we were having before the show started in the champagne room about this white lady?
Yeah.
Okay. I would love to hear what people have to say about this. I'm sure you guys have maybe read about this. It happened about a month ago. A suburban mom got caught with a multi-million dollar theft ring where she had people in various states stealing things at different Sephora's and Lens Crafters and Ulta Beauties and then reselling it on Amazon. I went off a little bit when I heard about this, and I want to get your guys' opinion on this. Alex and I were having a conversation about this before the show started, so should be an interesting champagne room. Thank you guys so much for all the comments. I know I'm gonna get. I hope we get some good comments for this show. Again, there's going to be a lot of people that don't agree with what we say. There'll be people correct us. Like, in actuality, that record came out in 80, not 79. Don't be that guy. If I can remember that something came out around that time, Jesus Christ. 46. Thank you, guys. And we...